everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable. This is episode number 131. Today we're discussing The Legend of Korra, Season 4, Episode 1, After All These Years, and Episode 2, Korra Alone. Two very intense episodes for sure. If you'd like to get in contact with us and discuss these crazy intense episodes, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a comment on this post on hypeable.com. You can also hang out with us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So, fun facts. Karen, what's your fun fact for today?
This one's for Caitlin in particular because I just started watching The 100 Season 2. Yeah. And I'm so into it, but it's really stressful. And I just think about it all the time, but I kind of don't want to watch an episode because I know it's just going to end on another horrible cliffhanger. And I'm just going to have to wait that much longer for Season 3. So it's a very precarious situation right now.
Oh, but it's so good.
I need to watch The 100. Caitlin, what's your fun fact?
I was talking to my baby niece today over Skype. She lives in Australia, and she said my name for the first time. And she called me Auntie Quaitin.
Aww.
And it was really cute.
So that might be the funnest fact we've had on Fun Facts.
And she's really adorable, and she's really obsessed with things being cheeky. So she was like, I'm a cheeky monkey. That's what she was saying today.
Oh, foreign children. Brittany, what about you?
I'm eating lots of Cheez-Its right now, and I've noticed that the crunching is interfering with me being able to hear in my headphones, so I've put the Cheez-Its aside for the recording of Rewatchable. But my actual fun fact is that I've had the most stressful reading experience of my life reading Magnus Chase, because Karen is so invested in Rick Riordan novels that I feel the need to update every time I tell her something. I'm like, no, but I'm really liking it. So I'm almost done with it, though.
That's Karen, good.
I have to give you a final update before we record later.
Yes, please.
Okay, well, my fun fact was that I just started Magnus Chase, actually. So.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's okay.
No, don't tell Karen that.
I mean, I'm a little, whatever. I'm not hating the book, but
so this is my first. This is my first Rick Riordan book.
Oh, there you go. That makes Then you'll probably really enjoy it. Cool. All right, so let's get into chapter one after all these years. In this chapter, Doc, by the way, brought to you by Ariana today. In this chapter, 3 years have passed and everything is still pretty much a shit show. But on the plus side, there's a terrifying dictator statue of Korra in the middle of Republic City Park. So, yay. And everybody's like, what? 3 years have passed? Like, the beginning of that was very traumatic for me, I remember. The crew, meanwhile, who we have to admit, kind of all lucked into Team Avatar in the first place with their striking good looks and willingness to fawn over Korra, are not exactly finding their societal contributions to be gang-level leadership worthy amidst a post-apocalyptic Avatar world. It's not quite that bad. Blin is accidentally aiding and abetting a dictator, Asami is once again getting hit on by fuckboys, and Mako and his hottie new haircut have bitch duty babysitting said fuckboy, the Earth Kingdom's prince. Woo! Yeah, I think we should call him that. Speaking of haircuts, Korra should have mental breakdowns more often because she's pulling off that Katie Holmes bob like a babe. At least the airbenders have turned into sexy nomadic superheroes. This is all true, basically. Also, Korra's missing. Yeah, all right. So, Karen and Brittany, I'm very interested in how you guys felt coming back. And I was like, oh, it's 3 years later. Whoa, okay.
Did not know it was 3 years later. But I was like, wow, everyone got really hot over summer vacation. I was like, wow, all right. They all hit puberty at the exact same time. This is great. Because one thing I had a problem with at the end of episode 2 was like trying to piece in like when that was happening. because I kept thinking like 6 months, 6 months, 6 months. I'm like, when is this 6 months going to end? But it makes so much more sense that it's 3 years later. I hate the announcer guy, so maybe he said it was 3 years later and I just didn't listen to him.
He did, yes. He said that twice and gone for 3 years.
Yep, no, that's exactly why I didn't. I've tuned him out since episode two of Korra, because I mean, yes, he's the voice of like Chet Ubetcha in the extremely goofy movie, but just not a fan of him.
That's terrible. I love Shira Shinobi.
I know.
He picks Panamon.
I've just been really glad that we haven't had to have a conversation about him in a while, because I feel like I expressed my like not liking him enough in book one that was like, oh good, we're finally moving past this. I don't have to bring up every week that I don't like him. But here we are in book four. But I'm kind of glad we moved along that much, and like we've seen, well, I guess I'll talk about this more in the next episode, but that we've seen kind of what everyone's been up to and how it's been hard on every single person to not have their friends around, and they kind of had to pick up with nothing and move on. So I'm glad that we time jumped, because I think it makes a lot of sense for the narrative.
Yeah, for sure. And Karen, how about you?
I really liked it as well. When we saw Asami for the first time, I was like, why does she look so different? Did like the style change again or something like that? And then I kind of figured it out. I think I missed it too, Brittany. It took me a while to realize that we skipped time. But after that, I was like, you know what? This is a really good idea, because it shows consequences to what happened at the end of book three. It's not like Korra was miraculously better, you know, 2 weeks later. The fact that we had to jump this far ahead and she's still struggling with anything is huge for her character development.
Yeah, for sure. I think it was a very emotionally relevant choice for them to make. And it was also, you know, I think it's something that cartoon shows do from time to time. I think you have less luxury to do that on like a live action show. But I really, really enjoyed this. Caitlin, do you remember having any feelings about the time jump? Were you thrown off by it, or did you like it?
I mean, I remember liking it, but it felt kind of unprecedented, because Avatar was such a condensed time period for three much longer seasons than Korra is. So it just sort of feels like, wow, they actually went there and are spacing it out, because we just really hadn't seen that up until this point. But I think it works really well.
Yeah. I remember also being really thrown off by the Air Kids, actually. Being like, what? How are you guys adults, basically?
Milo is unrecognizable.
Yeah. Milo the boy has become Milo the man. Ariana notes that she thinks it's creepy as fuck that they have a massive statue of Korra. You know, I think this world is a little bit of a sappy world. They like to commemorate people in statues. Like, it kind of
makes sense. Everybody has statues. There's a Zuko statue at the train station, and there's statues all over the place of people.
But is Korra, like, I know this sounds awful, but has she done enough to deserve a statue? Because I feel like her whole it will probably be the same with Aang. Aang probably deserves a statue with all of the team, you know, the gang. But I feel like Korra's kind of like, like right now, right at this moment in time, it's more of a reminder of like, where is the Avatar, as opposed to like, look what the Avatar has done. You know what I mean? So I feel like maybe later in life, yes, it's definitely going to be deserved for everything that has happened up until this point. But for it to come this early, it's sort of like, well, where is she? Like every day when people walk by it, they're kind of like,
I think it probably has something to do with the harmonic convergence and that having a noticeable effect on Republic City, you know, and like, yeah.
Yeah, I just think like if the Avatar was going to be gone for this long, I mean, I didn't expect her to be gone for this long, granted, when they probably designed this statue and made it, but
that's what I was going to say, like, I imagine it went up.
Yeah, and then they were like,
after.
Okay, well, she's not here. It's been 2 years, you know, like, where is she? sort of deal. Yeah. So it just felt a little, like, odd that they had it there.
Mm-hmm. So everyone is up to different kind of things. They haven't actually seen each other in a while. Asami is kind of becoming, you know, she's working with the government to create new technology and being awesome. And Ariana is calling her Mary Sue. And I'm just going to note that that is, no, I'm disagreeing. And her hair is awesome. How did you guys feel about the changes? Caitlin, what did you think about, you know, Mako kind of obviously advancing through the ranks, but now being stuck on Wooty, if he's Wooty. and, you know, Bolin off with Kuvira, and yeah, the Airbender's kind of kicking ass.
Oh, poor Mako. He's finally found his niche, and he's really good at the police work and detective stuff, and then he gets stuck on this horrible guard duty for this really horrible guy, and he gets stuck with it even longer. I just feel so bad for him, but I'm going to also take exception to Asami being a Mary Sue, because she's awesome, and don't say things about Asami, basically. Bolin, I mean, I guess it's kind of him. He's trying to figure out what to do, because Mako always had a place. Like, he had that place in the police department, and Asami had her company that she had to rebuild in the wake of her father going to prison, and Korra had her avatar stuff. So Bolin's always been a little bit more in the wind, so it kind of makes sense that he would fall into somewhere that's kind of rigid, and it gives him a place.
Yeah. I'm actually wondering what you guys, the newbies, particularly think of Bolin in terms of, you know, him being partnered with Kuvira, who seems to have a negative agenda, possibly. Actually, you know what? What do you think of Kuvira? Let's talk about Kuvira.
I don't trust her.
Warning, I'm a massive Kuvira stan, but yeah.
I do not trust her at all. I think she's planning to take over the world. In terms of Bolin, I'm a little worried about him being with her, because I think Bolin is very gullible, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think that he's naive, and he has a very positive outlook on the world, and he can be kind of sucked in sometimes. So I worry that he's maybe getting in deeper than he thinks he is, and he might be end up being manipulated because of that, but I do like his hair.
Hair. Everyone's hair is really exceptional.
Yeah, Mako and Bolin got really hot, I'm not gonna lie. They look great. Especially when Mako came on, I was like, okay, you grew up a little bit. Oh, but you're still a little pouty, so we're gonna have to get over that.
But it's Woo, so it's like...
Yeah. You know. No, it's justifiable 5 minutes after you first see Mako.
Yeah.
I'm like, I get it. I get your mood. But Kuvira... She's like Lynn on steroids. Like, I don't trust her, like Karen said. She is a badass. Like, when she took down all those bandits by herself, I was like, okay, that's pretty cool.
That was awesome.
Yeah, and she's like not into, like, you know, physical, like, in violence. Like, she like doesn't really hurt anyone. But yeah, I have a lot of trust issues with her. But Bolin, I feel so nervous for, because over the past 3 books, I've grown really, really attached to Bolin and his humor. And just when you see him, like, you know, helping people and giving out food and stuff, that's the part of the job that he really responds to. Not necessarily, like, you know, taking the orders of Kuvira or seeing the larger picture of what she's trying to do. So I think he's getting caught up in that, just like he kind of got caught up in the mover. Which Adiana calls terrible. I loved that plot line. I thought it was hilarious. But he does get caught up in like the glamour of job descriptions, sort of like the fame in that respect. But in this respect, like the smiles on the, like the poor people's faces when he hands them a box of food. So I'm a little nervous about him, and I'm kind of glad that Opal was mad at him, because it might wake him up a bit.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about this whole thing is that Bolin is actually acting, I think, more mature than we've usually seen him. You know, and that he's good, like he wants to help people. Like he's really excited about that and he's good at it. And, you know, like having Bolin, I think, has been looking for his purpose for a long time, and the fact that he has found it with Kuvira is telling on multiple levels. But whether or not it's destined to continue going well is, I don't know. Any thoughts on the disintegrating relationship with Opal, and maybe what might have happened between Sue and Kuvira? I almost said Sue and Lynn right there, but it's Kuvira this time that she is deep with.
So is Kuvira, who is she? Like, is she, like, I just don't know who she is. Did I might have missed something major. I know she's engaged to Opal's brother, who has clearly had a falling out with their mom. Was he the one who was, like, running around with their father when they were in the, like, metal city? Remember, like, when the father was like, I'm too busy to eat, and he runs away? And then...
Oh, yes. Yes, that's Batar.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. So he's and the one
do you
who's
remember Kuvira?
Engaged to Kuvira.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember Kuvira, I guess. I must have missed something somewhere along
the line. Kuvira, actually, if you go back and watch book three, is all over the place. She is she's from the Metal Clan, and she is one of the dancers with Sue. She is the captain who reports on the, like, when the Red Lotus breaks in. She's the captain who is, like, updating Sue, and she's, like, you know, surround the perimeter or something like that. She is also the one who saves Tanrak from falling.
Oh, so that's why we were supposed to have paid attention to her
yeah.
in that particular moment. Okay, but we yeah. didn't know who she was.
No, we didn't know at that point.
Okay. So that's who, okay. No, that makes so much more sense now.
My yeah. mind is blown right now because she kept popping up, and I was like, they're clearly using that guard over and over again, but she doesn't seem to have a lot of significance to the storyline. Like you were saying, she was just the one, like, reporting in stuff, but they kept focusing on her, and I was like, she's super shady. I don't trust her. Why do they keep panning over to her? So.
See, it's so funny that you noticed that, because I did not notice at all. Like, I did not remember her, like, when she showed up in book four. And then,
I
like,
didn't either.
Yeah, the only time she stood out for me was when she was, like, to Tanrak, like, oh, you can call me Kuvira. And it's like,
yeah,
why would
yeah.
we do that?
You're I didn't right. notice it until we rewatched.
Yeah.
But I forgot the name. So that would make more sense. If I remembered her name, it would have stuck out. Because I remember talking about it during the finale. And we were saying, they were like, oh, did you notice anything? And I was like, yeah, well, that girl, like, she was given a name. But then I didn't remember her name, obviously, when I started watching book four. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's sort of like that Azula thing, like, where she was just, like, you know, there during the Agni Kai. And I was like, who is that girl? And they were like, don't pay attention to the girl. Not yet. Don't talk about her. She doesn't exist. I was like, okay.
Yeah. But I love that they seeded her in that way, and really to such an extent. And I love that she is, she's so formidable at this point, you know, like, there's no question that Kuvira is in charge. Like, there's nothing about her being female or whatever. She's just, like, I mean, it wouldn't be in the Avatar verse anyway, but, like, we haven't had that many female villains, and to have her kind of come out and be this unbelievably powerful, like, completely controlled person. Like, she does this thing where when the train stops, she, like, barely moves. It's, like, kind of almost a little unnerving, but yeah, I really like her.
Yeah, and female villains that we get are so often not like Kuvira. They're, like, the femme fatale, like, seductress, and how often do you get, like, dictator women?
Yeah.
So it's such a nice change of pace, if you can say that for a villain.
Yeah, exactly. It is so funny, like, when she's like, oh, Batar and I are engaged, and it's like, you don't seem like a sexual person at all, but okay. That was just my opinion. But yeah, what else have we got going on? We have elsewhere in relationship news, I guess. Kai and Opal are not in a relationship, but they go out on an airbender mission. Karen, how did you feel about the costumes, about their costume change and their new kind of like Batman role in the world, except dead parents?
I kind of liked it, actually. It set them apart, and like Brittany was saying, they do kind of feel like superheroes. So that was kind of cool. And yeah, I'm into it. I like the fact that they're helping people despite being alone. I mean, Opal did say that everyone's sort of spread out all over the place right now, and you could tell that kind of hit a nerve for her to admit, but she's still doing what she needs to do, and I really respect that. And it seems like they are helping. I mean, they're up against a lot of odds, but they're trying their best, and that's really all they can do.
Yeah, for sure. But I guess tied into that is an interesting point that the Earth Kingdom is not in a good place right now, politically. There are bandits all over the place. There are, everything's kind of going nuts. And so we have Wu, who seems like a very poor solution to this problem, perhaps. I don't know. Caitlin, what do you feel about the politics going on here?
Wu is like exactly the reason the Red Lotus were doing what they were doing. So they get defeated, and then someone that they are like, this is our point, comes to the throne. But it shows you that the death of the queen, like, it 3 years later, they're still in turmoil. So that's pretty intense. So it shows just how bad things got in the wake of the queen's death and all the Red Lotus stuff going on, and that's pretty intense.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, this is your best okay, all right.
Yeah, but like, clearly something has to be going on, because like, Raikou is so into getting him on the throne. They're like throwing this whole like coronation thing, and like, for the fact that he is even there and like trying to be part of the orchestration, like, something is going on bigger than just him being, them having a figurehead on the throne, because the whole place is in disarray. And why would they be having these earthbenders trying to go and unite it, to have a false leader lead it? Like, it's, something is going on, and I just want to know what it is. Ah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very strange situation where, right, like, this independent city state is kind of coronating the leader of an independent nation. That's huge. That's also being re-pieced together by a military leader. And there's a lot of complicated stuff going on right now. But actually, on Wu, does anyone have any specific thoughts on this new young fellow?
He's like the Varric we don't want.
I was actually going to compare him to Varric. I actually like Wu, not because I think he's competent at all. I just think he's funny. But he's definitely like, I don't know, dumb Varric. It just, he's fun to have around and to laugh at. But my God, I hope he doesn't actually end up getting any sort of power, because that is going to turn out very, very poorly.
Yeah.
He doesn't even know what he's allergic to. Like, like, oh my God, I'm allergic to strawberries. And he's like, no, you're not.
Oh, I always mix up that and bee stings. Because they're so similar.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the way Mako reacts to Wu. It's really funny. Yeah. So are there any other topics that you guys want to discuss for this episode? I mean,
Ariana's point about how we've seen a lot of the other nations in Legend of Korra, and when are we going to the Fire Nation? It is a question I've been asking since book one. I just want to go to the Fire Nation, like, so badly.
Yep.
And her idea, Zuko gets thrown a big birthday bash and all the gang babies have to go and hang out in Ember Island. Brilliant. Like, that's the next fan fiction I'm writing. Island.
But Amber Island is probably like even crappier now.
Oh, but it would be so much fun.
That's true.
Well, for me. Not for probably any. It'd be so much fun for me.
Yeah. That's funny. Ariana also has a couple predictions. She thinks that Wu is going to be dead by episode 5 and Kubira is going to assassinate him, which is an interesting point of view. She also
wondered, just to interject really quickly, I was like, yeah, that's definitely a possibility, but I kind of wonder if he's going to stay on the throne but become her puppet.
Well, something does happen, but I don't remember what episode. I'm not saying assassination or anything, but there's a specific development that I'm wondering if that's episode 5, but I guess we'll figure that out. I don't remember if there were any other predictions. You know, this episode ends with, you know, Tonrek arriving, and because everybody's getting together because there's, you know, we're having this awesome coronation for Prince Wu and terrific, hooray. Korra does not show up, and Korra should have showed up about 6 months ago. So this episode definitely ends on kind of a WTF moment. Newbies, did you have any... I mean, obviously, you presumably just clicked right over and watched the next episode. But did you have any reactions about, like, oh my god, where is Korra? Or were you just like, oh, okay, she did her own thing?
Well, I was hoping... clearly, she didn't die, because then there would be a new Avatar. But I was like, oh, maybe she's off in, like... I really thought that she was, like, off in the spirit world somewhere, just, like, trying to figure out, like... something, or she lost one of her elements when she was like injured, because she clearly couldn't try all of them out when she was in the wheelchair. So I was like, maybe she's like in some sort of like isolation, which kind of was half true in a way. Like, I'm sure we'll talk about this much more in the next episode, but she like, I guess, can't connect to her avatar state anymore and like all this stuff. But that's my predictions were kind of in line. But it, like you said, it only took place within like a 5 second span for me to click like next episode.
Yeah. And I'm an idiot and just forgot that we do get that scene at the end of, yeah. Of course,
well,
I'm
like,
fighting.
Yeah, she's fighting. Yeah. But, you know, like I was sort of like, well, maybe she like needs to like, you know, clearly like maybe she lost her earthbending because we only saw her trying to earthbend. So I was like, okay, maybe that's her problem. Like she's really trying to get back on her feet and like, you know, her bending abilities and stuff like that, but
like it was a much more complicated.
Yeah, it was a much more complicated story than I imagined.
Yeah. Any predictions, since we don't really return to the main A plot of Republic City in the next episode? Any predictions for what's going to come next with Mako and dealing with Wu and Asami and the Airbenders and Kuvira?
Hostile takeover.
I hope that Mako is not just sitting like around saving this guy all the time from pies, because that would get really old. So I hope he like actually discovers some like really creepy lurk, like, you know, people lurking in the crowd and not people just armed with pies. Like there's actually a battle, because after the book 3 finale, I was just like bending, so much bending. And then we get to this episode and I'm like, like, where is all the bending? I was so let down. I was on such a bending high. And then it was just like, oh, right. All right. We got to take it back down and build up to the bending.
Oh, you are not going to be disappointed.
Oh, good. I love
bending. There's some amazing stuff that goes down. Ariana is also happy that Korra cut off her, and I quote, ugly ass ponytails.
Yes. I'm so excited. I hated those things so much.
Part of her culture.
It doesn't matter. Like, Katara looked awesome with her cultural water tribe hair. Like, that hair was great. This hair was just, it was rough. Not a fan.
Also, I liked it, but I will say I did like it better when she chopped it off.
She looks so good.
Yeah, no, I like it. I like it for sure. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because I don't watch a ton of animated shows, but I watch... I cover Star Wars Rebels now, and like those guys never ever change their costumes. And I don't know if it's because of the way they're animated, like that's digital animation and this is more hand-drawn, but like they're like nobody takes off like a jacket or whatever. It's weird. And I really appreciate that in Korra. I like Star Wars Rebels, not crapping on it, but yeah, I think this show is definitely very sensitive to what people are wearing when, you know, and why they would be doing that, and that includes hair and stuff. So let's move on to favorite scenes. Brittany, what's yours?
Mine was Opal, like, jumping off the air bison to save Kai when the bandit had ripped his, like, flying squirrel suit. So I thought that was pretty awesome because it was kind of cool to see them in action. And I liked that they had these awesome new suits that allowed them to fly without, like, being able to fly, sort of like we saw last season. So it was a really cool way to use their airbending.
Yeah.
Human gliders.
Or flying squirrel suits, as I like.
They do look like flying squirrels. Yeah. And I love the way they're designed. Like, they click mm-hmm. into, you know.
I can't wait to see Boomy in one. Ready looks great.
Yeah. That's good times. Kaylin, how about you?
So mine was Kuvira taking down an entire band of bandits, like a total boss, like one woman and this big group of people, and she just owns them. Like, that was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, she is pretty cool. Okay, Karen, how about you?
Just seeing everyone grown up, I like the way that they changed, because like you were saying, in a lot of other animated shows, they don't change, and that's fine, but I think for me, starting with Korra and Avatar, it's kind of spoiled me because they do such a great job of like people's hair growing out and then getting cut again and all these different ways to make it so real that when it doesn't happen, you actually start to take stock in that. And that kind of takes you out of it a little bit. But just seeing how everyone's like subtly changed, some more than others, was really nice.
My favorite scene was Kuvira talking to the governor, because there's a lot of, first of all, I love Zelda Williams' voice, and every time I host an episode for this, I will just be whining about Zelda Williams and Kuvira, whining in a good way. But I love the political machinations of that scene, how it's like, there is a massive threat of violence there, absolutely, and Kuvira is totally manipulating this guy, but there's also like this like thread of like righteousness there that's going through her, and just like complete confidence and power. And you know, obviously, you know, all the villains that we've had on Korra have been very confident in their abilities, obviously. Which maybe one of the reasons season two is different is because that season is so much about Korra being overconfident and then underconfident. I don't know. But I really love that, you know, we just have Kuvira not only in bending and not only in, like, her strategy, but in her, like, straight-up politics. You know, she is completely dedicated to this and just like terrifies the guy. She scares the crap out of him, and I love it. Yeah. Favorite lines, Brittany.
So my favorite line was from Bolin, my main man, who, when being mocked about his hair, says, "Hey, Kuvira says it makes me look intelligent," and he has like this little like, you know, what's his name from Hairspray, Link Larkin, like twist in the front. You know, he looks great. So I thought it was really cute, especially after she like messes it up, and then he kind of like pats it back down when everyone comes off the train.
Yeah. Caitlin.
Mine was Prince Wu, and he's talking to the people in charge at Republic City. Says, "Are we all positive that the Earth Kingdom is safe enough for me to return? I don't have to remind everyone what happened to my great aunt 3 years ago. Oh. May she rest in peace."
Yeah, this guy's a charmer.
Oh my god, it was horrible but hilarious, and everybody's face and response just, it was good.
Yeah, they were like, "Oh, we're doing this? Okay, we're doing this, all right." And Karen? Another woo line.
Yes. FYI, Caitlin, that was like my second favorite line, so I'm glad you picked it. But my favorite line was from, "Oh no, Mako, I've been hit. It's a gusher." It was so funny and ridiculous. And like, the guy cannot seriously be that stupid, but he kind of is. And I just love it.
Yeah, he likes the strawberry jam.
I need to look up the voice actor, because he just really goes for it all the time. My favorite line also related to Wu, when Asami just says to him, like, he's like trying to flirt with her over the, not flirt, it's just straight up weird, about the whole train house thing. And she says, "I do look like the idea of putting you on a train and sending you far, far away." Because I thought that was great. All right, so moving on to chapter 2, Cora Alone. In this episode, Cora's alone because her parents are still dumb as fuck to the bone. Ariana, oh my god. They loan the most famous person in the world, who is also suffering from PTSD, a robot, so she can wander off into the unknown alone. Trusting her on her own, alone, they never bother to check in on the phone, despite noting her known mental stability is not exactly in the zone. Are we, like, rhyming now? I feel like, yes, she is. She's officially rhyming. Okay. Feeling lonely, Cora Mulan chops her hair off on her own and finally ditches those ugly-ass cargo pants that should never have been sewn. As Cora alone, her avatar identity is not known because Superman logic says people's heads are shaped like a cone. Feeling scared and on her own, she pretends to be Joan, getting beat to the bone, and fighting off her visions alone with a moan. Fortunately, in that swamp, our own Yoda Toph has been living alone. So she finds Cora and tells her, "Bro, your avatar identity is blown. A long time ago, we used to be friends, and the tone of your twinkling toes is well known." Well done, Ariana.
Oh my god. Well done.
I feel like there's definitely another Hamilton influence here. But yeah, okay, so Cora alone, the first kind of note is that if you are just watching Cora, you won't get the significance of this title. But obviously for those of us who have watched Avatar, this connects quite directly and harkens back to Zuko alone. So.
Zuko.
Did you just need to say that, Brittany?
I did. I'm sorry. I purposefully, as you were building up to it, took myself off mute. So when the time came, it just, you know, happened.
All right. Yes. Fist raised. Zuko. So Karen, how did you feel about the connection to Zuko alone? Did you feel that this episode measured up?
I didn't really notice like any sort of throwback to that. I was kind of taking it at face value, but I will say that seeing Cora so alone and dejected, I kept thinking back to season 1 when she was just all over the place and she was so righteous and she was so hung up on like doing the right thing, and not that she isn't now, it's not like she's turned into a bad person, but she is so completely different from the Cora that we saw back then, and I almost don't even recognize her in so many ways, and a lot of people don't. I mean, they're kind of like, "You kind of look like that Avatar person, but nah, it can't be you." And I just think to see her this dejected really worries me, because, well, I mean, obviously this is the beginning of the season, so they're going to build her back up. But it's the final season, and I just wonder, being at such a low point, how is that going to affect her for the rest of her life? Because it's not going to be easy to get back all of her powers and all of her confidence.
Yeah, for sure. And that's definitely a strong note in this season. Brittany, as our, you know, noting the Zuko, how did you feel that this episode compared?
Well, as soon as I saw the title, I did go back and look, like, just I didn't rewatch Zuko Alone, but I kind of like read.
Sure, you didn't. Sure.
I did not. I read the wiki page, which is basically like watching it. But yeah, it wasn't as flashback heavy, I guess, or like, you know, it wasn't filled with so much self-reflection. It was more like, oh, this is going to be her healing journey, which made sense for Cora's story because she had a lot to come back from. And just watching her be so depressed was harder than I thought it would be, mainly because I haven't really liked Cora up until this point. We're in book four, and I finally came around to Cora in the conclusion of book three. So, you know, it's been a long journey for me, and now to see her, like, it's horrible to say, but I'm finally interested in her story. She's, like, having a rough time, and we're seeing her react in a way that, I don't know, it just makes her more human to me as opposed to this, like, you know, not that she, I don't want to say, like, not that she wasn't human before. If you've listened to this podcast up until this point, you know how I feel about Cora up until this point, but I don't know, I appreciate the way that they're taking her story, especially because they could have just, like we were saying in the last episode, picked up 2 weeks later and Cora's fine. So I'm kind of glad that we're going on this journey and to see her from still being in a wheelchair and, like, you know, lying in bed and having these nightmares, and she's dealing with this, like, PTSD from all the stuff that's happened to her. I just appreciate the story a lot more going into the season, but it wasn't Zuko alone, sadly.
Yeah.
Which I might watch after this, because it was
That's always a good thing to do, I think. Caitlin, as a massive Zuko fan who has lived with Zuko alone for a long time, how do you feel?
I mean, this episode isn't stylized in the way Zuko alone, which is very much evoking the whole Western thing and all those tropes of Western films. And this one was more kind of, this is what happened while she was gone. So it doesn't quite evoke it in that way. But I think the emotional depth is still there because it's just, it feels so much more adult to me. Like, you can really see how the show has grown up, because how many animated shows do you know of that address their main character having PTSD? Like, they don't.
And so, not in a conversation, in an entire episode.
Yeah. So it's just, it's taking on such mature themes, and I find that extremely satisfying to see that they're not brushing anything under the rug. And it kind of does parallel Zuko, because that's really when we get to know him very, very well in Avatar Season 2. So there's that importance kind of for both of them. But this one, I feel, has just, it shows the maturity a lot of Legend of Korra.
Yeah. And I will say that I think a similarity is, I don't think this episode is quite as successful as Zuko alone, because I don't think that, you know, because of so much of Zuko's mystery came from the mystery of it and us having no idea, you know, really what he came from and learning those hints that we got in that episode. However, I do think that, you know, both Korra and Zuko in their alone time have lost a major part of their identity, or the major part of their identity, really. And, you know, so these episodes both definitely show them trying to find that. And, you know, for Korra, obviously, that's her strength, her ability to bend and be the Avatar. And it's very difficult for her. You know, Ariana actually notes that, like, in season one, she did kind of, like, have that at the end, like, boom, your powers are back, you're good, you know, it's all good, moment that a lot of people found unsatisfying, whereas it's definitely not the case here. Even, you know, months and months, it takes her several months to even agree to go to Katara, you know, and then, you know, from that, it's several months of her, like, being healed, and from that, it's several months of, you know, walking again. It's a real struggle. Karen, how did you feel about seeing Korra, like, just the detail paid to her physical struggle and the time that was invested?
Yeah, like I said, I really enjoyed it, because when it happens instantaneously, it takes away a lot of what that character is going through, and they kind of just, you know, kind of shrug it off, and then you don't really explore it again. But I have a feeling that this is going to be a big thing for Korra, at least for, I'd say, like, the first half of the season. I mean, they're going to spend some time with this, considering everything she's going through in this episode in particular. And just the fact that, you know, she didn't want to go see Katara. And when she was there and she got so excited about, you know, moving her big toe. And I was like, okay, is this going to be it? Like, is this going to be the end of her struggle? But no, it wasn't. Like, then she started walking. When she fell down, she just wanted to give up. And she yelled at Katara. And it was this constant back and forth, which I think is very realistic, especially when you go through something as traumatic as what Korra has gone through. It's not an easy journey. It's a journey of ups and downs all the time. And Korra is alone. She doesn't have her friends with her. And I think that's a big part of why she may be struggling too.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Although I would argue that I think, like Zuko, there's a certain point at which these characters have to be alone. You know, that there has to be almost like a walkabout, like a personal reckoning. You know, sometimes you can't. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not really a secret that the show is kind of, and Avatar even more so, were kind of powered by like Eastern philosophy, and you know, we have the whole chakra episode, and I think there, you know, you can't meditate with someone. You know, you meditate by yourself. It's a personal journey that you take. And I think that this is definitely something that Korra is doing, which incidentally is why I have to disagree with Ariana. She says, so Korra goes off on her own for 6 months. Everyone knows she's fragile. And seriously, none of these dumb fucks think to call up and check on her. I assume they're talking about like her parents. She's talking about her parents. But I actually think that, I mean, first of all, this has been 2.5 years. You know, it hasn't been, it's not like Korra just went off on her own, like, right away after being hurt. It was a very long time of her trying to deal with this by herself. And Ariana just came back to the dock, so I feel like she's stalking me. but I really think that, you know, this kind of personal reckoning is something that Korra needed and something that she knew she needed. And I think I feel bad for her parents because, you know, she was sending them letters and she was lying to them about being fine. But, you know, I don't know if there was anything better that anyone could have done. Caitlin, how do you feel about that?
I mean, I think I agree and disagree with that she needs to be alone. I think there is some that she needs to do on her own. But we've seen, like, the power of friendship in these shows is so important. And then just even having that emotional support could have helped. So it just, I don't know. I understand why she freaked out and went out on her own. But it does seem like maybe she could have reached out a little more. But I guess she probably wasn't in the headspace to actually ask for that help either.
That's how I feel, Michal. I love your analogy of, you know, you have to meditate alone. You can't meditate with somebody else. It's something that you have to do for yourself. And I agree with that in her decision to get better. I think that had to be done alone. You know, somebody couldn't just be like, look, you're the Avatar. You kind of have to get better now. Chop, chop. You need to go save the world again. It's something that she had to be like, all right, you know, this is something I need to do, not only for the world, but for myself. And I have to decide that I want to continue living this life that I've already been living. Once she's past that stage, I think she needs to be with her friends. I think she needs to see the people that she affects on a daily basis in order to keep herself going in that same direction. I think it's definitely a balance between the two. And the mental state that Korra is in right now, I really worry about her being alone because I think she just continues to get really down on herself. And she needs somebody like, you know, Bolin to make her laugh and Asami to kind of understand where she's coming from and Mako to kind of be the serious one and kind of just listen to her. And the fact that she's not surrounded by those people just makes me worry that she's going to get even deeper into a depression.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think this should be permanent by any means. You know, I do think Korra needs other people in her life, but I don't think that this particular trip that she goes on is, you know, Korra has made some very bad decisions in the past. And I don't think this is necessarily like the smartest decision in every element of it, especially because Cora doesn't really seem to have a plan. But I, as I said, I think it's sound in its logic, in a lot of ways. I want to talk for a second about the contact that Cora does have with some other people, which is, first of all, the letters, that,
the letters are they, so good.
Yeah. This is basically like the best thing ever in Cora. Yeah, Cora gets some hilarious letters from Bolin, some also very funny letters from Mako, and some very heartfelt letters from Asami, and Asami is the only person she writes back to. So, thoughts on this?
I mean, how could you respond to Bolin? It was like a freaking novel. It had like 9,000 pages, drawings, like she just felt so inferior to Bolin. And then you have Mako, who's like the most awkward turtle to ever exist, including the random lion turtles, because they're pretty awkward. They just appear whenever you feel like it. But I mean, Asami makes the most sense. Asami was like her gal pal. I would feel more comfortable writing a letter to like my best girlfriend than that awkward boy whom I used to date and kind of like doesn't know what to say to me. Be like, what would you say to him? Like, thanks, Mako. And Bolin, again, like I said, I wouldn't be able to match it. So by the time I finished reading it, another letter would have been there.
That's true.
And so Asami like made the most sense, you know, to be like, she asked questions, you know, wasn't just like, hey, thinking about you, you know, I don't know.
I think that Bolin's letter is the type of thing where somebody writes you like a really elaborate like Facebook message, someone that you, I mean, I think Cora does want to hear from him, but theoretically someone you don't really want to hear from like writes you a really elaborate thing and you're just like, huh, LOL, you know, and like try to ignore it and that's all you say. But it's hard to send an LOL by letter.
I think there's also a degree that Cora, maybe for Mako and Bolin, feels like she needs to be okay, and that she feels like they need her to be okay, or at least more okay than she is. And whether that's true or not isn't, you know, that's not necessarily true, but that's probably how she feels. Whereas Asami, she feels comfortable being low, and she can talk to her. They have a level of intimacy that she doesn't have with the boys, and I can see her, she's getting these, you know, look at all these great things we're doing, so, and she's just not feeling that. It's just really hard to write a letter kind of trying to be okay when she's so not okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, I tried to really think about it logically as opposed to emotionally, so that was really good. I agree with everything Caitlin said.
Yeah, definitely. Cora also has a lot of time with Katara in this episode. She also she gets a little bit of a burn at one point, sort of in a Katara kind of way, where Katara's like, you know, like Aang lost his entire culture. You know, everyone he knew was dead. Here, you can walk. Did anyone else take it that way? I'd like try not to.
Yeah, but part I of feel like can't. she was trying to one up Avatar her, being like, I met this Avatar who like lost everything and like he was still able to get up in the morning. Like, what's your problem? And I was like, Katara, like, what is wrong with you? I was actually a little put off by Katara in this episode. And especially when she's just sitting there, like, sipping her tea, I was like, what are you doing? Come on, this isn't you. So, like, whenever I felt like it was so snot. I know it wasn't, because I actually rewound the episode and listened to it again. But I felt like she was just like, whenever you're ready, Katara, like, I'll be here sipping my tea. You know, but it really wasn't in, like, it didn't have that inflection. But that's how I heard it the first time, because I was like, whoa, there is no way they're making Katara like this.
Yeah. Karen, any thoughts on Katara?
I didn't take it that way, but maybe I was just not, I don't know, like paying close enough attention to it.
No, I don't think it's really that way. I just think it's like she's walking a line, and I don't know if the story means us to like go on the side of the line that I kind of tipped over onto. But yeah, I just can't help but see it sometimes.
I went there initially until she elaborated on what she meant. It sort of felt like she was like, put your problem in perspective. Aang lost his entire culture. I was like, whoa. But then it was like, and then he found meaning. And it's like, okay, that's where she's going with it. But the very first few things she says, you kind of like, where are you going with this, Katara?
Yeah. And I mean, I've been sort of on the side of where you were with Caitlin with the first few things Katara says about Korra the entire series. Because I've just been comparing it to Aang for the whole series, but then I'm like, okay, yes, Katara has a point. Like, she has to put it in her own perspective as to, like, it's not a black and white comparison. It's more like, okay, find the similar gray area and work it out. But I think that was my biggest problem going through books 1 through 3, so I'd be happy to go back and watch them again after we're done, because I had so much anti-Katara feelings. Not Katara, Korra. Ah, oh, their names. Too close.
What I actually ended up picking up on in that scene was the way that Korra snapped and the way that Katara just kind of took it and was like, okay, I know you don't really mean this. And then Korra apologized because, again, very realistic. I'm glad that it wasn't like this whole big falling out where Korra's just like being a brat and she's like, you know what? I'm done. I can't do this. And she doesn't walk away, but that was bad. I apologize. But, you know, she was like, all right, I realize I'm being unreasonable right now. It's just very difficult. And then Katara was like, you know what? It's okay. I understand. I know you didn't mean it. And it was a very, there was very good communication there between the two of them. And that's important to me.
Yeah. And that's a realistic thing that happens. I mean, you know, people who have to rehab injuries, like, it's an incredibly difficult, incredibly frustrating, slow process. So, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's a very mature situation that is going on between the two of them. And, you know, and it's great to see Korra's, like, little, you know, her little victories. Like, this girl who was, like, the second we met her was, like, all about power physically, you know, just like being so happy that she can move, her toe, you know. It's really cool. So on her, you know, kind of walkabout, Korra goes through a couple things. First she realizes that she's not quite at the bending level that she used to be. And she also kicks off, goes around, meets a guy who took a picture of Aang, which was awesome. Can we just all have a moment of appreciation for this picture of Aang?
It was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I really loved it.
And funny thing, because I think I heard the writers say, like, at one point, like, the reason they decided to do that was because they realized that, like, basically every time Aang had been in the series, he had been, like, super serious or, like, at best, like, smiling with his family, like, kind of austerely. And they were like, no, he's still Aang, though. So they put that thing in where he did that trick, and that was just awesome. So she winds up in the Earth Kingdom. She starts kind of going to these, you know, earth bending fights and sees herself as a spirit flashy thing. Thoughts, Caitlin?
Well, the initial thought is clearly that she's hallucinating and it's, you know, her PTSD manifesting from her horrific experience. But then when that spirit comes in the guise of the puppy dog, it is really adorable. The dog, like, it growls at it. So clearly there's something more than just a hallucination going on, which is very interesting, because how would a spirit be able to see her hallucination?
Mm-hmm. Karen and Brittany, do you have any thoughts on the Negakora, as I like to call her?
Well, it made a lot more sense after the dog was not a dog anymore, although that dog was so freaking cute, but the spirit was a little bit cuter. I love the voices of the spirits. They're so adorable. But it made a lot more sense after the dog turned back into the spirit that Korra is kind of battling her avatar state. So I wasn't sure if she was just like hallucinating, like it was one of her like more lucid, like, or less lucid moments, like, you know, when she would have these like traumatic flashbacks, like when she's training and she's trying to show off to Tenzin, like, you know, and she's like seeing all these like horrible flashbacks. I wasn't sure if it was one of those type of things that was going on. But when the spirit was able to see it, then I was like, okay, clearly she needs to get into like some sort of spiritual world or landscape. And that's where this battle is going to really take place for her to like reconnect with her avatar self and sort of just like gain the confidence she needs to re-establish herself as the avatar, because right now I don't think she believes that she's the avatar anymore. Like, she's gone too far down that like depressive hole, and so she needs to find a way to reconnect with Rava in a way. Rava, is that the good one?
Rava's
I didn't want to like, you know, start a whole new dark avatar thing, so I just wanted to make sure I got it right.
Yeah. And Karen, any thoughts?
Basically just the same things as you guys were saying. Definitely thought it was hallucination at first, and after that I was like, okay, now I'm confused. But I thought it was really interesting. I thought the dog was going to be evil, though. Like, I thought it was going to grow 10 times its size and just like try to devour her. Really glad that it didn't.
You read too much Rick Riordan.
That is true. That is very true. I'm really glad that it didn't, though, and I'm glad it turned into the cute little spirit. I thought that was nice.
Korra also, you know, she goes to the spirit world. She goes back to the tree, very kind of, you know, revisiting the events of the previous seasons. You know, eventually she winds up in the swamp place in the Earth Kingdom, and she meets someone there.
This is the person that I was like, oh, I know is coming, because you were writing this article while we were doing Avatar, and the feature image was Toph, like a really, really old Toph. And I was like, Toph's coming back. But we had to wait for a really long time for it to happen. Like all of Freaks and Geeks and the first three books of Korra for it to happen.
They really, really hold off on Toph. Like they, I mean, because she could have showed up in book three. I mean, they really kept this one.
Yeah,
they
but I'm so confused why she's here. I mean, I'm glad that she's here, but is she like able to speak with spirits? Like, I'm interested to know more. I know we don't get a lot this episode, but I really want to know. I'm excited to find out like what her purpose is here.
Any theories?
Not just yet. I didn't really have time to think about it. I kind of watched these episodes and then left my house today. But I don't know. She definitely has to have some connection to the spirit world, because the spirit who came to get Korra was like, someone wants to see you. And so she has some sort of connection, and she can feel, like, she can't see Korra, obviously, but she's able to like connect with Korra's spirit and kind of know that Aang is around. But so is Korra maybe going to be rejoined with her past avatars in some way? Because if she can sense Aang, then that's a huge thing, because Aang isn't around anymore. Like, Korra can't talk to her past selves.
Interesting. Karen, any theories?
Oh man, I was just excited that she was there. I think she's going to come back so she can kick some ass, or at least hopefully that's what I want to happen. And yeah, I mean, Katara is around, but Toph being there, I would love for her to be the one to help Korra. I think that Katara obviously has more of a connection to Aang, but I always liked Toph better, so if she's the one to help Korra reconnect with her past, that's totally fine with me.
Also, I really, 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 really want Bolin to meet Toph. Like, really want that to happen. Just a whole episode of him, like 22 straight minutes of him just standing there with his jaw hitting the floor will be fine with me.
So that brings us to the end of this discussion. Shout out again to the idea that Korra chopping her hair off was so Mulan, because it was, and that was awesome. Any last thoughts before we move on to scenes and lines?
Let's just remember that Aang had a vision of Toph in the swamp.
Yes. Very
good
point.
I did not
point.
Remember that. So that's
before he met her.
I'll have to go back and see what that's all about. I really, my biggest fear with watching Korra is thinking about all of these things that happened in Avatar, and I've been so good so far to not go back and rewatch an entire episode, because I feel like it's just going to set off me watching the entire series again, and I just do not have the time for that right now. So I'm so, like, torn between just, like, I have to get through Korra, and then being like, I really don't have the time right now to go back and rewatch Avatar, even though I want to so badly. Oh, I can't wait to rewatch it. Christmas break, that's my treat to myself.
So that was our discussion on Korra Alone. Definitely let us know your thought. Brittany, what was your favorite scene?
Okay, so my favorite scene from this episode was all of Bolin's letter moments, from when he gives her the first note before she even leaves to when she's reading the long note. But my, like, specific favorite moment within that was when she's looking at the drawing that he did of, like, Pabu and Varric, and it just reminded me of, like, Sokka doing the drawing of all of them at the end and Zuko being like, I don't look like that. Like, it just I loved it. It was so great.
Yeah, that was awesome. Caitlin, what about you?
So mine was the picture of Aang doing the tricks, because it's really adorable and it shows that Aang remains Aang even in adulthood. And like you guys were saying, you know, we've only seen him in Korra being very serious, but it shows that, you know, he still has this joy for life and love of people, because he lets the guy take his picture doing a trick and he's all gleeful about it. So it just shows that Aang remains Aang through it all, and that gentle soul he has kind of persisted through life, and that's really wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Karen, what was your favorite scene?
Toph's return, because how could you not? It was great that they kept her hidden for so long. And then when you started getting an inkling of who it was, you're like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I was like bouncing in my seat. So yeah, it was really exciting.
And my favorite scene was just the seeing the dog slash Spirit Guide. Cause I just really like that thing. It's really cute.
It's so cute when it climbs into her lap.
Oh my God.
At the tree.
It is,
oh,
get
oh,
it.
So cute.
Adorable. Brittany, what was your favorite line? You stole the best one. I hate you.
I stole all of the best ones, and it is Bolin's letter to Korra. So he starts out and he says, "My dearest Avatar Korra, though several fortnights have passed since your departure to convalesce in the homeland of your tribesmen, I feel our friendship knows neither time nor distance. You will be most pleased to learn that I found gainful employment with Sir Varric and Lady Kuvira. I set off on the morrow with some trepidation, but I am eager to offer any aid I can in stabilizing the Earth Kingdom."
Korra,
he's
LOL.
So cute. Yeah. So it would be like that meme that's just like scene 5:57 p.m.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that was awesome. And I love that it's contrasted with those drawings. It's like the best.
It's like this like really like high elegant language. It's just like these stick figures with like a mustache for Varric.
I'm not sure. I think PJ Byrne might have ad-libbed some of this. I'm not sure. It's possible.
So good.
Yeah. And Caitlin, what was your favorite line? You have a good one too.
See, I feel I have the only correct line from this episode, which was Toph saying, "Nice to see you again, Twinkle Toes."
That just, like, punched me right in the heart when she said that.
Yeah.
But she's not technically seeing Aang because Korra no longer has her connection to her past lives.
I mean, she's technically not seeing anyone.
Quote, unquote. With her feet.
Yeah. Thank you, Brittany. Thank you.
No problem, guys. Sokka's not around, so someone's got to take the lead on that one.
Well, yeah. And Karen, what was yours?
Bolin saying, "Spoiler alert, Pabu and I already miss you."
Very sweet. Yeah.
Cute.
Speaking of which, where is Pabu, though, 3 years later? Dun, dun, dun.
Do we not? Okay, now I'm worried.
Did we not see Pabu? I didn't think about it. I thought Pabu was on Bolin's shoulder when... Oh, well, but that was 3 years ago. Oh, my God. I have to watch the next episode right now.
Well, my favorite line was...
While you send everyone into a panic.
My favorite line was, I'm just going to be stupid and do Mako's because I just really like his letter too. He's like, hey, Cora, so I'm not very good at writing letters. It's 2:15 in the afternoon. Weather is fair. Chance of snow showers later today, but enough joking around. I just love that, like, I don't think he was conceived as this dour and this humorless at the beginning of the show, but I love that the writers have just found this, like, completely absurdly literal, like, strain in Mako and really gone with it. Because I just really love it. It's awesome.
He's so awkward and wonderful.
Yes. The more awkward Mako is, the better he is. Because, like, that's, like, you can relate to that, you know? And I just also love his conversation with Lynn when she's like, so I sold you down the river. You know. Okay, awesome. So we're going to get into some listener feedback now. If you would like to send us listener feedback, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at re_watchable. You can leave a comment on this post on hyperbole.com. You can also come talk to us on Tumblr or talk to Brittany on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. And you can leave us an iTunes review. If you rate us 5 stars, then a long time ago, we used to be friends. Ariana, that's not a thing anymore. We're way past this. Maybe we'll like call you by the nickname that you had in a previous life. How's that?
Yeah,
that works.
Okay, cool. All right. So our first piece of listener feedback comes from, actually all of our listener feedback comes from Hypeable this week from the post. And we're talking about last week's episode, which was the finale of season 3. So, Carl, I'm so sorry if I try and pronounce your last name, it will not be good. Thank you, Carl, for sending this in. He says, the here can fly, he can fly, hashtag Voldemort. But actually, in my opinion, he is not the first one to have shown that ability in the show. Back in Atla Book 2, when Aang was trying to master the Avatar State with Guru Patik, he was asked to let go of his earthly attachments. May they be bad, loss of his people, or good, Katara. When he finally willingly enters the Avatar State during the battle in the underground of Ba Sing Se at the end of Book 2, he floats without an airbending ball around him. So I always thought he was flying. Guru Patik was the first Air Nation acolyte we met, so he could have known about Guru Lahima's deeds and maybe developed his method to unlock the Avatar State based on Guru Lahima's philosophy. Or maybe it's the other way around. Guru Lahima could have unlocked the secrets of the Avatar State and gained the ability to fly in the process. And Ariana actually notes that, I think it's Ariana. Did anyone write that? Or is that Ariana?
I think it's her.
Yeah. So she comments below that she also thought of that. That Aang was too obsessed with Katara to meet his full potential. Maybe, depending on how you see it. But that's a good catch, actually, because that's quite cool. I had not remembered that or thought of it. Anyone else? Any thoughts?
I was just rereading it to see when he said Aang was floating. Because was Aang in the Avatar State? Because I feel like everyone can float in the Avatar State.
I mean, Korra was flying in the Avatar State, but she was using, like, fire propulsion.
Yeah, yeah. But he only says that he was floating during the bow. Yeah, when he willingly enters the Avatar State. He was floating, but he wasn't really flying. I feel like floating in the Avatar State is different than being able to, like, propel yourself.
That's true.
I don't know. I mean, that's a very good catch. I never would have thought of that little detail, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like the Avatar State is something different than being, like, just not an avatar and being able to do it.
Yeah.
Like, it would be cool if, like, Tenzin just randomly started flying, but he will never be able to let go of his earthly attachments.
Nope.
Because he's got far too many of them.
He has children. That's the end. Yeah, no, that is cool, but I think you're actually right about that, Brittany. I think maybe the air, like the avatar state is actually kind of airbending without without necessarily it looking like it, because they're just doing all kinds of stuff in the avatar state. And maybe they also just meant like the only airbend, like actual, like just airbender to do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see. Caitlin, you want to take the next one?
Okay, I'm going to butcher some names, so I apologize in advance already.
We have someone
So,
who's smart and writes us about stuff that is smart.
yeah, and this is totally beyond me. So, this comes from Dreamer, who says, "Hey guys, this is vaguely off topic, but I was in an East Asian history class the other day, and my professor brought up Empress Dowager Cixi, as she really reminded me of the Earth Queen. While not as extreme, she was fairly self-interested and did a lot of unusual and harsh things to centralize and maintain her rule. Some historians even credit her for the fall of the Qing Dynasty, but it's debatable. The Earth Queen's character design is also very reminiscent of many of the phones of Cixi you find online." So, interesting history lesson.
Yeah, I'll bet that she's probably inspired by that. These writers are smart. They know history.
Indeed.
Yeah, the headdress isn't as extreme, but she does look like her a little bit.
Yeah. Cool. And Brittany, you want to take the next one? And since it's a reference to something that you very much love.
Yeah, I do. So Sophia Malik, finally, someone responded to all of our Hamilton chatter. There were a couple on Twitter who were like, "Yay, Hamilton!" And then everyone else who doesn't get Hamilton is being very quiet, which I appreciate. And so Sophia says, "Perhaps the real question is not who is the Angelica in the relationship, but who is the John Lawrence?"
I love this.
Are people shipping like Hamilton and Lawrence without reading the biography?
I don't know if without reading the biography, but I think people have become aware of the possibility.
Because I mean, because I didn't read the biography, because I'm not reading the biography, but my brother is reading it, and he's like, "Oh yeah, people think that there might have been a thing between Hamilton and John Lawrence." Apparently, there's a whole group of like scholars who are convinced that basically all of the founding fathers were gay. So that's
Yeah, I mean,
interesting.
if you Google John Lawrence, the second post that comes up is about the Hamilton Lawrence relationship. And so like, and it's all about like a gay historian who contends that they had a relationship. The first is his obviously his Wikipedia page,
Right, yeah.
the most factual account of his life you'll ever read.
Actually kind of cool because, like, I mean, I certainly didn't know who he was before, and now we do. That's cool.
Yeah. But that's funny. I appreciate that people are chiming in about Hamilton.
Absolutely. Cool. So, yes, and Ariana adds this 1,000 points to Gryffindor. Yes. And somebody add an I don't understand that reference, GIF.
That would be
Oh,
Caitlin.
Castiel. Okay, so there you go. All right. But thank you so much, guys. If you would like to join us next week, please do. I mean, you should, because we're doing this anyway. So come listen. And book two is freaking awesome. So yeah. Thank you for listening. My name is Michal.
I'm Brittany.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Karen.
Bye. Flameo.
Bye.
Bye.
Awesome. Sorry, I just got distracted because my sister managed to get good Star Wars tickets. So, yes. I'm sorry. Speaking of Star Wars,
Yay!
where are
You
they?
just add the time. It's like center. It's exactly what we
Oh my
want.
God, is it
11 o'clock.
3D?
I knew
It
11.
doesn't matter.
That
Okay,
was
awesome.
fair.
I'm sorry, guys. Don't even cut that out. It's fine. There was a lot of Star Wars drama this week.